Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Men in Science podcast. This episode is a conversation with journalist writer Sean O'Connell talking about his new book, With Great Power, talking about the history of Spider-Man in the films, going from all the failed attempts way back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, all the way to the successes of the Raimi trilogy, and then Andrew Garfield amazing duology, rather, and then on to him in the MCU, Spider-Verse, and so on. And it was a very, very wonderful, insightful conversation. We talked about, you know, we shared our love of Spider-Man, and even asked him a little question about the Snyder fans. Yeah, check it out. Here we go. All right, I'm happy to have you here. It's a very, I guess I could technically say, my first celebrity interview that I've done on this channel so far.
No, aim higher, please, aim higher.
I'm happy to have you be the first one, because I'm even though I haven't been following your career that long, I became more familiar with you through, I think, when you were on a Film Junkies podcast stream a few years ago.
Okay.
That's when I became more familiar with you, so I've been following you ever since then. But yeah, for anyone that's going to be watching and listening to this, you know, feel free to introduce yourself and let the world know who you are.
Absolutely. My name is Sean O'Connell. I'm the managing editor for a website called Cinema Blend. I've been with them for, I want to say, 8 or 9 years now at this point. Started as a staff writer for them and climbed the ranks. And I've written two books. One is called Release the Snyder Cut, which was a behind-the-scenes look at the people who were involved in the movement to get Zack Snyder's Justice League released. And when I was working on that, I definitely got the itch to keep writing and to find new subjects to go after. And my all-time favorite superhero character, fictional character in general, and my all-time is Spider-Man. And so I figured I would start poking around there and see if there's enough material, essentially, or how to shape a book about Spider-Man's history. And I realized how I was interested in a number of the false starts, you know, that plagued his early days. And then, you know, it seemed like almost every iteration, even the most successful ones, came to controversial ends with, you know, Raimi having to use Venom for part three, and then not being able to get his part four off the ground. And then
Right. Everything
that happened with Andrew and Emma. And, you know, I thought there were a lot of stories there to tell. So I started to dive into Spider-Man, and it has led to this new book called With Great Power, which documents his Hollywood history.
Yeah. And it's been like I tweeted a couple of days that it's been a kind of an educational experience, because the only failed start that I was aware of was the James Cameron one. I was not aware of any of the other, you know, like the B movie horror version of it, the musical that would have had Elton John playing Peter Parker. I was not aware of any of those. So it's been interesting to learn some of those kind of stories. So you mentioned how after writing the Release of Snyder Cut book, you wanted to find something else to write about. So was Spider-Man the first one that you jumped at, or did you have other ideas before you landed on Spider-Man?
No, that was the one that so over the course of writing the Snyder Cut book, I was lucky enough to pick up a literary agent. The first time through for the Snyder Cut book, I had no clue what I was doing, and I did all of it on my own, essentially, in terms of cold pitching query letters to publishers, potential publishers. And I managed to get interest from a publisher and then a literary agent after the fact. So at the very least, he was there afterwards to help me, like, okay, so what other ideas do you have and what else might you want to do? So I sort of told him about Spider-Man and how much I was interested in him, and I sort of mapped out what I thought it could be. But then, and every author should do this, you have to sketch out as much as possible of what the book is going to be, because you're bringing it to a publisher who may or may not know whether you can write or not, and they want to make sure that what they're investing in, you know, has meat on the bones, essentially. So once I started to put together, like, well, I definitely want to tell the story of when Andrew Garfield went to Comic-Con and surprised, you know, the audience by being in a makeshift Spider-Man costume. Well, I definitely want to get into what happened to Shailene Woodley's Mary Jane Watson and try to get the real story there. Well, I really want to focus on the fact that Sony and Disney, you know, share the properties of this character now, which is an historic deal between two studios who just studios don't play nice together. They don't. And so to have two studios do this, I thought all of this was kind of remarkable. So once I laid it all out, I was like, oh yeah, there's definitely a book here. It's just going to take a matter of doing all the research for it.
Yeah. And you definitely did your research. I mean, I'm only halfway through the book right now. Like, because I was just finishing up a little while ago. I'm at the, just before they started production on Amazing Spider-Man 2. That's the part that I'm at the book so far.
Okay.
Nice. And just even everything else up to that with how, like, even with the first two Raimi Spider-Man films, how, you know, how much, you know, how much he had to go through to get his story told the way he wanted it for those two movies. Because, I mean, most people that are fans of Raimi, they know that Raimi is a perfectionist. So, and, you know, and you can kind of see how he mapped out the story for those two films. And then when Spider-Man 3 came along, how, yes, it had a lot of the Raimi-isms, as people like to call them, but you can tell that this was not 100% the story he wanted to tell.
Well, and also, like, what I was fascinated with the two films, the first two films in particular, was how much they had to solve physically transitioning this character over from comic book to live action, right? How do you make it believable kind of thing? Because no one had seen swinging through the city like that, and no one had seen climbing walls. And these were all physical problems, like logistical problems that you have to solve if you're going to have Spider-Man be your main hero. And so, you know, we talk about story point a lot and casting and trying to get the right guy to play Peter, but, you know, there are guys like John Dykstra, the visual effects artist, who is working behind the scenes to try to show Sony, this doesn't have to be all CGI. We can do this with real people, you know, and we can do it with stuntmen. But even down to stuff like, I would hear stories from the visual effects artists of just like the way Spider-Man lands, you know, when he lands on a rooftop, it's going to blow out the knees of any other normal person. So how do we do it to make it look convincing? How do we not, you know, take the audience out of it every single time Spider-Man tries to do something unique? And so that's why I think that they are so proud of those final swings at the end of 1 and 2.
Yeah.
Which, you know, they're a trademark of the franchise now at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one thing that I did kind of miss from the other Spider-Man films. I mean, the first Amazing Spider-Man did have the final swing at the end, but it was absent from the second film, and it was absent from the Tom Holland films up until No Way Home. So it was nice getting to see that, you know, kind of full circle from 2002 with Toby, and then 2021 with No Way Home ending with Tom Holland having his own little swing like that. And because, like, for
he got
me,
a good one too. I like his.
I would say from the first Spider-Man and then No Way Home, that those are my favorite, like, final swing sequences that I've seen. Because, like, for me, Spider-Man, like, I would consider, like, the, like, if there was a Mount Rushmore of superheroes, it would be Batman, Superman, and Spider-Man would be the top three for sure. Because for me, you know, there's, as far as my favorite superheroes, there's Superman and Spider-Man are right there tied to each other. Although lately, and especially rewatching a lot of the Spider-Man films, I'm feeling myself more drawn to Spider-Man even more so. And part of that is also because, you know, like how Toby says in Spider-Man 3, just a nerdy kid from Queens. I grew up in Queens, New York also. So I identify with that a lot as well. And also just the aspect of just him, just Peter Parker being like that outsider character trying to find his way. That's something pretty much everybody can relate to, you know, at whatever point in their lives. So, you know, it makes Peter Parker especially a very relatable character, no matter who is reading or watching the stories that are being told.
Yeah, or if it's not you, it's at least somebody that you know, you know, like you can point to that person and be like, oh, I know exactly who that kid is. And then you stop and think like, well, what if that kid got these powers? You know, how would they use them? And the way that Stan Lee, going all the way back to the beginning, set him up as someone who is plagued by guilt because of a mistake that he made so early on, you know, which compels him forward still to this day of why he can't stop being a superhero, no matter how hard it can be for him. It's a remarkable, remarkable storytelling trait that they lucked on, you know, in the earliest days of his formation.
Yeah, that's definitely a case of lightning in a bottle, you know, for when Stan Lee and Steve Ditko created that character in that story.
For sure.
Yeah, I do have a few questions here because I reached out to some people to, you know, get some good questions. And I mean, you've already answered a few of them so far without me even having to ask them. So it makes my job a whole lot easier. When did your love of Spider-Man begin? Like, was he something from your childhood? Did you find him later in life? Like, what's your Spider-Man origin story, basically?
from my earliest childhood, I can remember, so I grew up in the 70s, and I was watching the 1960s animated series, because it was on reruns or on a loop whenever I got home from school. And I just thought that those were the greatest cartoons. You know, I loved Spider-Man's sense of humor more than anything else. You know, I loved that he was quippy and sarcastic and kind of fearless. That was a gateway into the comics. And then his presence on television was still pretty prominent. He was a member of the show called The Electric Company, where he would show up in little shorts every once in a while. And I always thought that was really exciting. Then he was in an animated show called Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, where he was with Iceman and Firestar. And I watched the daylights out of that.
Yeah, I used to watch the reruns of that too. So I remember it pretty well.
He was omnipresent, you know, and there's like a line in the book that Chris Miller, who worked on Into the Spider-Verse, said, where he's like, I don't know what came first. Like, did they put Spider-Man everywhere because he was popular? Or did Spider-Man become popular because Marvel put him everywhere? You know, like, he was in TV shows, he was on lunchboxes, he was on Trapper Keepers, he was on as much merchandise as you could possibly do. So was it just force-fed to us, you know, that we became to embrace him? Like, if they had done that with Thor, would Thor become the more popular character? But then I, you know, started working in the film industry in terms of covering it in 1999. So right around the time that Sony was starting to ramp up production on Raimi's film. And then from that point on, I've been lucky enough to sort of track his film progress moving forward. And with an eye towards, you know, I'm a diehard fan, I really want to see that you treat this character's legacy the right way. And then I nitpicked a bunch on the first Raimi. And then I thought he redeemed himself a bit in the second one. So
Would you say that the second Raimi Spider-Man film is your favorite out of all the Spider-Man movies? Or, because I know that's the general consensus with most fans, at least.
So I honestly think that Into the Spider-Verse is my favorite of all of them.
Right.
Simply because of the way that they expertly handle almost every facet of Spider-Man. You know, weirdly, my favorite reading of Spider-Man in that movie is Chris Pine's. Like, I think that he comes across with the, I'm exhausted, you know, I'm still going to keep fighting back. He's got the best quips in that movie. But I love that Miles is prominent in that. My wife is an elementary school teacher, and I can't tell you how many kids at her school, their Spider-Man is Miles. He's Miles Morales because of that movie, you know, or the recent Bendis run kind of thing. But then you pull in, you know, Spider-Man Noir and Spider-Gwen and even something as goofy as Spider-Ham, but it shows you how malleable, you know, this character can be. He can fit so many different molds and still be important to different people. And so I love what Into the Spider-Verse does. I loved Stan's message in it. And I think it was heartbreaking because it was his last, you know, that movie came out shortly after he passed away. And so for him to get past the costume to Miles and tell him that, you know, the mask always fits sometimes. And I thought it was really beautiful. For live action's tougher. I think I'd put No Way Home above Spider-Man 2. But it could be Regency bias, obviously.
Yeah.
But you know, seeing the three of them together on screen is
Of course. That's you know, ridiculous. a dream come true for so many fans. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I would as of right now, I mean, I'd have to rewatch all the movies again. I would say Into the Spider-Verse and Spider-Man 2 are kind of neck and neck, because Into the Spider-Verse, when I saw it in theaters, even now with everything else I've seen since then, probably the most fun I've ever had in watching a movie in theaters. And I think it's the only movie that I can genuinely say I was smiling from the start of it to the end of it, and just the best time I ever had, especially the post-credit scene with Oscar Isaac as the that one. I've reused that GIF like so many times since then, when I would just randomly message people. I just love that movie so much. And
it's terrific.
Yeah. And I'm excited for when Across the Spider-Verse comes out next year. What is it, next year or the year after?
It's next year. Yes.
Right.
I think it's in the fall. I think it's all the way back to October of next year. But yeah, they're going to, because they have Madame Web also to come out, and Craven and Madame Web coming out next year.
Yeah, I'd almost forgotten that they were already in deep into production for Kraven.
It might almost be done. I've heard rumors of test screenings happening over the past couple of days, because I think it's a January release, Kraven.
Really?
Huh. I think so.
That's interesting. Yeah, I didn't even, I mean, I knew that, that they had been filming it, these last few months, and didn't realize how deep into it that they were. Yeah, let me look that up. I'm curious now, too.
Do you have a lot of hope for Kraven the Hunter?
I mean, I do have some hope. I mean, because I am a fan of Aaron Taylor Johnson, so I feel like he would do very well in the role. And it's just, I guess, because I haven't been as big of a fan of the Venom films other people have been. So not necessarily my faith in Sony has been shaken. It's just, I would say maybe more cautiously curious about it. If that makes sense.
Well, I'm seeing that it got moved back to October of 2023. So
okay. All right. Yeah, I see that now too.
That could be more accurate.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully that one will be a film that delivers as well.
All right. Let
me look at some of the other questions on here and see if there's anything that hasn't been touched on already. All right. Oh, yeah. This is one that actually I was curious about. If there was like any stories of any other failed starts or failed attempts that didn't make it into the book, you'd be able to share.
Not necessarily. I tried to cover as many as I could. I tried to really go down the list. The one that fascinated me the most, which I wish I could have gotten more detail from, was the Cannon Films one where Joe Zito, the director, wanted to make the most expensive Cannon film of all time. And Cannon, for people who might not know listening to this, is a notoriously cheap studio that would sell the international rights to titles that they had, even though they never really intended on making the movies, kind of thing. So they would turn a profit and then usually like sell that title on to the next person. But Joe Zito had done a missing in action film with Chuck Norris, and it was a bit of a hit. He'd done Friday the 13th Part 4 with Corey Feldman, which was a bit of a hit also.
Yeah.
So he wanted to make a Spider-Man movie. He wanted to make a legitimate Spider-Man movie. And he went over to London, where they had studio space, and he was starting to build out sets. He had, bridge sets and city sets and all this stuff. And he wanted to cast Tom Cruise as Peter Parker. And Cruise at the time was coming off of The Outsiders and All the Right Moves, where he played a high school football player. So he hadn't exploded yet. I think he was about to have, he might have had Risky Business already underneath his belt, but he hadn't done Top Gun. Like Top Gun was his next movie, in which case it would have put him completely out of the realm of playing Spider-Man. But that's the one where like I would love to have had more time to sit down and talk to people who worked on that. Like I interviewed Joe Zito, and I spoke to some of the people at Golden and Globus who were running Cannon at the time. But I would love more people who were involved in that production just to see how far along they got in it. Because at every step of the way, what fascinated me the most is if any of those projects take off, then Spider-Man's history is completely different. You know, if Cameron and Leonardo DiCaprio do a Spider-Man movie instead of Titanic, you know, the industry changes. It's completely different. You know, we never get the James Cameron that we know right now because he doesn't do True Lies. He doesn't do Titanic, you know, and he maybe never gets lost in Pandora. Maybe he does four Spider-Man movies in a row. So I always found all of those, you know, signposts along the way of Spider-Man's history to be fascinating.
It is very intriguing to think of what the history of Spider-Man films and just Hollywood in general would have looked like if a lot of these films had been made. And is there anyone that you were trying to interview for the book that you weren't able to get a hold of?
Sam. I would love to have spoken to Sam directly. And he was just bad timing. Well, first off, Sam Raimi is notoriously press shy. He just does not like doing press and doesn't want to sit down for long form interviews. But the bulk of the time that I was working on this book, he was immersed in Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness.
That makes sense.
And, just couldn't, you know, surface above water to contribute to the book. But I got a nice note from him that he essentially said, you know, I appreciate what you're doing. And then I was happy enough to speak to a number of people who were on his team in John Dykstra and Don Burgess and Jim Acheson, who worked on the costumes. And then I worked with interviews from Toby and Kirsten and Bruce Campbell and folks like that to sort of round out those chapters. And then Matt Tolmach was a invaluable asset. Tomac, people might not know who Matt Tomac is, but he was the head of Sony film distribution at the time of the Raimi films. He was one of the driving forces behind bringing Spider-Man to Sony, and then served as a producer on all three of the Raimi films, both of the Mark Webb films, and is still partnering with Amy Pascal on most of the Sony Spider-Verse films. Like, he's producer on the Venom films and Morbius, and he's got his finger in the pot. So Matt's been around forever and was able to really fill in a lot of the blanks on stories that I needed specific details on. And I got a number of different conversations with him where he walked me through some key details. And so they asked me, this was the best review I could have gotten for the book, because Tomac's people asked me to send a draft just so they could make sure that everything that was in it was legitimate. And they came back and they said, you should be very proud of your reporting for this. And he said it was fascinating to go back and relive a number of the memories that he had shared and that other people had shared, and see it through somebody else's eyes, to see it told the way that it was told. And I thought that was a great compliment.
Yeah, that is probably the highest compliment I could think of for something like that. And yeah, because his name is the one that I've seen the most throughout this book so far. So it's very clear that he was very important in the creation of all these Spider-Man movies.
Him and Avi Arad, like, the two of them were partners essentially in bringing Spider-Man to life on the big screen with Amy Pascal's help. And then Feige's one more.
Yeah.
I never got Feige officially, although I've interviewed Kevin Feige multiple times over the years.
Yeah, because I noticed that you had the picture of him in the featured in the book as well.
I do, yes. So every time I got him, I would essentially ask Spider-Man questions, and especially the one time I got him specifically for Far From Home, where all we did was talk Spider-Man at length, kind of thing. So I had those insights and figured out ways to use them. But, you know, Marvel is such a tight ship, and trying to get them to come on and comment on. And, you know, what was interesting, too, is I don't know if you remember, like, Marvel had just put out that 2-volume set of essentially documenting the entire MCU. So they kind of had their own thing in play. And while I wasn't trying to cover the MCU as a whole, like, obviously writing about Spider-Man and how he is used touched on that stuff for the MCU. And so, you know, I kind of figured maybe they're saving some of the stories that they would tell me to put into their own book. And I can't fault them for that one bit. I mean, heck, I ran out and bought their book as soon as it dropped.
And a couple more questions that I have on here that, you know, some of them were from me out of my own curiosity, and the others, some people that I reached out to on Twitter. And this one from infamous Scallywag on Twitter. Regarding Spider-Man 3, she says, if the producers didn't force Sam Raimi to put Venom into Spider-Man 3, if you think that it would have been a better film.
If they didn't force him to? I think it definitely would have been a better film. Sam was way more fascinated in the Sandman story. And you could tell that whenever he had to expand on Eddie Brock and that rivalry, and, you know, most of the things that people goof on in Spider-Man 3 is symbiote related, you know, emo Peter Parker and, you know, the nightclub where he kind of humiliates MJ and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I would rather, if you think about the way that Spider-Man 2 created the bond between Peter as a scientist and Otto as a scientist, I think Raimi would have found a better way to expand on Flint Marko and make him a more sympathetic villain. You see some of it. You see some of it with his family and how he has to steal money in order to help his daughter, essentially. And I think if he could just taken a more traditional route, maybe we would have got one other villain included in, maybe more of like a classic era one. It could have been Mysterio. It could have been someone along those lines. But yeah, I much rather would have seen the purer version where Raimi could have done the heroes that, or the villains that he specifically wanted to do, and factor them into Peter's life.
All right, yeah, because I've always known that Raimi is more of like the Golden Age Spider-Man from like the original Ditko Stan Lee run. So
yep,
yeah, because I remember watching it was a documentary, I think, from the that I had on the Blu-ray for Spider-Man 2, where they taught him and Bruce Campbell talked at length about how much they loved they were reading Spider-Man comics and stuff growing up. So yeah, very clear that he would have tried to stick more to that era of Spider-Man that he was familiar with.
Well, and Raimi, Avi loved Venom specifically because Venom sold many, many, many toys at that time. He was very appealing to young kids. Venom was extremely popular in the comics at that time. Yeah. Like, it, you can't overlook the fact that he was a popular character, but to force a director to include him when the director has no insight into him and no real... Raimi couldn't figure out a way into Venom. He just couldn't. He couldn't do it. And it's even interesting when you get to the Venom films, because the movie that Ruben Fleischer set out to make is not the movie that Tom Hardy set out to make. And it was only when they were on set and Tom Hardy started doing exaggerated physical comedy, you know, and that was his reaction to, hey, if I'm going to become possessed by an alien, this is how I'm going to work, that Ruben Fleischer was like, I guess we're going to lean into the comedy of this, you know, because this is what my leading actor is doing. Because David Goyer, and I talk about this in the book later on, David Goyer has a treatment for a Venom origin story that goes all the way back to his home planet and how he, you know, ends up coming to Earth attached to a spaceship. And it's more comic accurate, and it gets more bonded to an angry Eddie Brock. And I think they could have gone that way if they wanted to. But Tom Hardy sort of took him in a different direction. So Venom is another character. It's just open to multiple interpretations.
Yeah, I'm sort of familiar with the David Goyer team, because I remembered watching one of the YouTube channels that I follow that he covers a lot of films that, you know, were canceled at whatever point in pre-production, and I think that was one of the ones that was discussed. And I remembered mentioning about the home planet and that, like, other symbiotes that come down, and there's like a big like battle amongst all of them. It's pretty fascinating, especially like hearing those kind of stories. It makes you just wonder how that could have translated into an actual film if it had been made the way it was supposed to be intended to.
Well, early on in those pitch meetings, when Avi was bringing Marvel characters around to the different studios, Goyer sat in on a lot of those meetings because he knew comics. He knew Marvel comics and he knew Marvel characters, and he was a successful writer coming off of a couple of hit films. And so I know he was in on an X-Men pitch, and I know that he was in on Blade, obviously.
Yeah.
And then started doing some, you know, Batman stuff with Aronofsky and then Nolan, obviously. So he's been immersed in that culture for a long time, and I think he has a number of treatments that could have gone one of those ways, and Venom is definitely one of them.
Yeah. Where do you see, though, with a lot of these characters, with whether it's the Spider-Man films or even with Venom, where do you see those going forward in the future?
That is a great question, because I'm not sure Sony even knows. It would make the most sense to me to allow Tom Holland to continue to be the Spider-Man in the MCU, untouched with whatever they're doing over at Sony, and just maybe get him going on another trilogy of films. You know, the fans have already started calling it the College Trilogy. Introduce a couple of characters, Gwen, Harry Osborn, folks like that. Let him do that thing and interact back and forth with, like, so I've heard a number of different rumors. I've heard that, you know, that after Daredevil Born Again, that Spider-Man 4 could be a continuation of that, where they do a sort of crime war, you know, New York street-based Kingpin, Punisher, Daredevil, and Spider-Man type story. Great, do that. But at the same time, Sony's building this entire universe of unrelated characters, and we've now established that it's a multiverse, and it's, you know, it exists somewhere else. Well, that somewhere else needs a Spider-Man, right? Like, eventually they're going to have to introduce Spider-Man into that world. And it seems like they always keep trying to do it. Like, there's the mural behind Morbius as he's walking down the street, or, you know, references in the Daily Bugle to the Black Cat and the Rhino and all this stuff. And you either make Andrew Garfield, you know, that Spider-Man, or you completely introduce a brand new Spider-Man who just happens to be the Spider-Man of that multiverse. And there have been hints or indications that Madame Web may go down that route, that Madame Web may figure out some way to bring in a Spider-Man who is the Spider-Man of the Sony Spider-Verse. And it will be separate from Tom Holland, and it'll be something that they could play with on their side. I don't know if that's true. I don't know if that's the direction they're going. There's a lot of mystery surrounding Madame Web, and I'll be really curious to see where that goes.
Yeah, I'm very curious about that too. And there's a couple of more. And there's one that I was curious about, and only because I was speaking with somebody about it yesterday. And this one is not Spider-Man related. It's more of kind of in relation to your previous book that released the Snyder Cut. Like, mm-hmm. and what I was curious about is what is your response to some of the Snyder fans out there that maybe don't take too kindly to you and how they feel a certain way about you, or I'll just, you know, say that they feel like you kind of exploited the movement. Like, how do you respond to that?
I'm very confused by that, to be honest with you, because I don't necessarily understand how I exploited the movement when my book really only set out to tell their story. Like, that was the whole goal of the book, was to tell the story of what these people had accomplished, to the point where the whole back half of the book, I opened it up for them to send messages to Zach that they wanted to share with me, because I figured if by any chance Zach was, you know, picking up this book and wanted to hear these messages of gratitude from his fan base, then I wanted that to be a significant part of the book. In no way, shape, or form did I demand that people pick up my book and read it. I was very happy for people who wanted to learn more about it. One of the critiques I heard about it is that, you know, people who were immersed in the movement knew almost everything that was in it, which I get, you know.
Right.
And the book, I kind of had to make a decision somewhere along the line of, like, who is this book for? And some of it was for the people who were immersed in the day-to-day of Snyder Cut, in which case I wanted to get quotes from Zach himself and some of the people who work behind the scenes, and maybe tell some stories that I knew that the people didn't know. But then at the same time, I wanted the book to also be a sort of primer, you know, a step in for people who are like, what is this Snyder Cut movement? Why is everybody talking about it? And which direction did it go? The disconnect, I think, that happened is that after I wrote the book, a lot of the people that I spoke with assumed that I was a cheerleader for the movement and that I would blindly follow them into the Restore the Snyderverse movement, which they immediately picked up and ran with. And I never believed in the Restore the Snyderverse concept, because I was of the impression that if you're fighting for one movie and then you get that one movie, you should be happy. And you should celebrate the fact that Zach got to complete that movie. But it so quickly turned into, no, we want JL2 and JL3 and make the Batfleck movie. And that behavior, in my opinion, backed up some of the criticisms leveled at these people online of, you're just demanding stuff from a studio. You're not really fighting necessarily for an artistic vision. You're just constantly wanting them to provide more and more and more.
Right.
And so I saw a healthy amount of the fan base who got Zack Snyder's Justice League say, great, I got what I wanted. That's fantastic. Thank you so much. And then there's another element that wants to just be mad online and keep fighting. And they tend to be the ones that blame me for exploiting the movement in any way, shape, or form. But, like, first off, if you know what a first-time author makes, like, it's ridiculous if you think that I've exploited the movement for any way, for any kind of financial gain. But honestly, I wrote a book that I thought amplified their story, and I wrote a book that I thought amplified their message. If I didn't stay in to fight their cause, you know, for the rest of time, I wasn't in the battle for that reason. I was in the battle to tell a story. And the fact that they wanted to keep fighting it, I didn't agree with that. So if they call me a sellout and a traitor, you know, for that reason, they're allowed to. That's fine. But I don't necessarily understand it, to be honest with you.
All right. That's fair. And then honestly, I'm kind of in the same boat as you in relation to that, where I was in it for the Snyder Cut all the way, because, you know, what happened to him was just tragic on all levels. But I'm not 100% invested in the Restore the Snyderverse thing.
Well, and because of logistically, as somebody who covers the industry and has covered the industry for 20 years, when I would sit back and think about all the things that had to happen to make those other two movies happen, they just don't seem realistic. You know, you're talking about actor contracts and actor schedules and other movies that are in the pipeline for DC. And now we have a complete change of leadership, you know, with James Gunn there, and who's going to back that? And are we really going to go with this? And Zach is over at Netflix and he's incredibly happy alternating between Army of the Dead properties and Rebel Moon and the amount of stuff that can come with that. And it just didn't seem feasible, you know, it was like trying to attack the program rationally versus the passion of the fan. And anytime I sort of said rational stuff, I was called a traitor or a snake or backstabber. And I was like, no, I'm just kind of giving my opinion about why I don't think it's going to happen. And then all of a sudden it was like, you manipulated the fan base. Well, no, all I did was just ask you guys questions. I just asked questions you guys gave me answers to, and I put it together into a story. You could have left me alone. You could have ignored me. You guys were all very happy to talk when I was telling your story. So I don't quite know 100% how I exploited the fan base when all I did was ask a bunch of questions and spend 18 months writing a book that I thought told their story pretty well.
Yeah, I think that's a good point to wrap it up, honestly, because it's, you know, I know you got to get over to the Marvel Alliance in a little bit. But I do appreciate you coming on here to speak with me. It's this was fun, honestly. I enjoy it. And I especially really do genuinely enjoy your book With Great Power. And I'm still only about halfway through it, but it's already a book that I've been recommending to a lot of people to go out and purchase.
Thank you so much. Well, first off, thank you so much for having me on. I really, really appreciate it. I thought you had great questions. And finish the book and then shoot me a response. Let me know what you think of it. You know,
I will do.
And tell me if it goes off the rails in the back half.
and sorry for all the other questions I wasn't able to get to, you know, but because I know your time is limited. So, but I appreciate taking the time to speak with me today.
Anytime, Julian. Have a great night. Talk to you soon.
You as well. Thank you.
All right. Bye now.
Bye. Well, there you have it. There was my discussion with Sean O'Connell, discussing all things Spider-Man and Snyder Cut related. Once again, that book is right here, With Great Power, the How Spider-Man Conquered Hollywood During the Golden Age of Comic Book Blockbusters. It's available on Amazon. I have the link directly to that for you guys to check it out and purchase it. It's a very, very wonderful book. As I said, I was only halfway through the book during the interview, but I will be finishing it once I'm done with this. But yeah, thank you all so much for watching, for listening, and for subscribing. And if you're not subscribed, please do so. YouTube, Spotify, Google Podcasts, CastBox, Radio Public, Breaker, Anchor, Apple Podcasts, and so on. All the links to everything will be in the description. Check out my social media if you want to have a discussion about Spider-Man or anything else, Marvel, DC, video game related, whatever. Twitter, Instagram, Vero, TikTok, Snapchat, you know, all those are in the description as well. And yeah, hope you all are doing well, staying safe, taking care of yourselves and your loved ones. Love and appreciate every single one of you who check out what I do on here, because I do it all for myself, but also do it all for you. And yeah, this has been the Men in Tights Podcast. I am Julian, and I will see all of you on the next one.